Following Christ After Christendom. The eighth talk at Gutenberg College's 2013 Summer Institute, How to Follow Jesus When You Cannot Kill the Beast, was presented by Tim McIntosh on August 3, 2013. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2013. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
I'm Tim McIntosh. I work at Gutenberg College. I read parts of Toby's speech, but I had to sneak out because I was still working on my paper. And you might think, oh my goodness, can you procrastinate anymore? Well, yeah, I was procrastinating, but part of the problem in a conference like this is because everyone is responding to one paper, Jack's paper. I didn't want to bump heads and say the same thing, let's say, that Ron said or that Chris said. So I delayed and delayed and I delayed. I kind of knew what I was going to say, but knowing kind of what you're going to say and actually putting in a paper are two different things. The title of my talk is Christians After Christendom. Sam Hobbs, my friend, where is Sam? I saw Sam a couple days ago at the beginning of the conference, and he said, so what do you think about Jack's paper? And I said, I think I agree with everything in Jack's paper, and I think I disagree with everything in Jack's paper. And Sam said, Tim, that sounds to me like a logical contradiction. And it is a logical contradiction, but I've been trying to make sense of two things. The fact that I agree with so many things that Jack said, but I disagree with so many things that Jack said, and I just think about things in such a fundamentally different way than Jack. It kind of surprises me because Jack and I have a lot in common, and the things that we have in common are probably the things that almost everybody in this room has in common. We have an allegiance to the God of the Christian scriptures. We have an earnest interest in the life of the mind. We have an interest in culture and politics. There's lots of education in this room. We are politically, I bet this room leans conservative, maybe even stronger than just leans conservative. Maybe just flat out, we are conservatives. We have similar socioeconomic and ethnic backgrounds. We have plenty of things in common. But I think if there's one biggest difference in the room, and I have heard a little bit about Toby's talk, so this may sound like familiar territory. If we have one biggest difference in the room, I think it is probably the difference between older and younger generation. And that's kind of the centerpiece of my talk. I have no idea how Toby's speech went. So if everyone is thinking, man, the healing happened during Toby's speech, we're ready to go. Summer Institute should be over. Then I'm sorry that I'm going to keep talking about the generational difference. But I'm going to try to make sense of why the generational difference exists. And I think the generational difference is more substantial than it has been at other times in American history. I think the biggest difference is that something happened in the world between Jack's time and my time. And that difference is that Jack grew up in Christendom. I did not grow up in Christendom. What is Christendom? It's a term I'm going to be using a lot in this paper, so let me define it. It's basically that world that David Crabtree described during his talk yesterday. He grew up in a time where culture, politics, church, and society were all broadly engaged in a similar project. Not the same project, but a similar project. Culture, politics, church, media, and society all formed a national consortium that instilled, taught, and upheld Christian values, or at least quasi-Christian values. I remember seeing an interview. I could cite so many examples. I won't belabor the point. I'm citing this mainly for people under 25 because that just sounds strange that I'm saying that culture was kind of united in upholding some sort of quasi-Christian values. So this is mainly for younger people. I remember seeing an interview with Mike Wallace of 60 Minutes fame, think Anderson Cooper of the mid-1960s, in which he scolded the interviewee for posing ideas that were, quote, counter to our Judeo-Christian values. I'm trying to imagine Anderson Cooper saying, you pose ideas that are counter art to our culture, to our Judeo-Christian values. It's unfathomable. That would never happen. And it's not just because Anderson Cooper is not a Christian. It's because we live in a post-Christian society, a post-Christendom society. Christendom was an imperfect world, to be sure. It was a racially segregated world. We could give a litany of the other problems of that world. But it was nonetheless a safe world where Christians could feel at home. Christians could feel at home raising children, practicing their beliefs, starting a business, going to church, reading their Bibles, teaching students. But that widespread agreement began to crack when the boy in David's seventh grade classroom decided to grow his hair out until it touched his collar. It's funny, when David told me about that example before, he actually used it in the talk, and David, I think, said it happened in 1964. One of my favorite authors is a guy named Stanley Hauerwas, and Stanley Hauerwas tells almost the exact same story. He dates it as 1963. He says, that day in 1963, Christendom began to erode. This is Stanley Hauerwas talking. It ended sometime on a Sunday evening in 1963. That Sunday evening in Greenville, South Carolina, the Fox Theater opened its doors in defiance of the state-honored blue laws. That Sunday evening, Hauerwas and six friends from the Methodist Youth Fellowship snuck out the back door of the church and joined John Wayne at the Fox. That evening, writes Hauerwas, represented a watershed in the history of Christendom, because that night, South Carolina, the last pocket of resistance, said to the church, no more free rides, no more free passes. What happened in the latter part of the 1960s is often described by conservatives and evangelicals as if it were wrought by an invading army, and I'm sure that it felt that way. My mom has told me stories, and she always describes it with war metaphors. To counteract the invading army, conservative Christians, evangelicals, fought to preserve their way of life. They fought in the classrooms, they fought in courtrooms, and they fought in the political arena. So imagine, let's just have a little schema that I'm going to refer to. I wish the whiteboard was still up here. Imagine that we just break culture down into two simple parts. The top part is what I'll call, well, the top part consists of media, politics, culture makers, and at the bottom there's just the simple one-on-one relationships of family, of friends, of coworkers. So what happened, I think, in the 1960s and afterwards are that conservative Christians were mainly operating in the top sphere, in this upper part of culture. And what I'm arguing is that upper part of culture and the lower part of culture previous to the day that the boy grew his hair out to touch his collar were of one piece. They were doing the same thing. After that time, there was a huge rift. Nonetheless, conservatives continued to operate up here, to some degree hoping to heal the rift between the top and the bottom. Does that make sense? Is everybody following that? I'll touch on it more later if it doesn't make a ton of sense. There remains among many, even people in this room, deep, deep anger at the invading army. Some pulled their children out of schools. Others raised their children to be culture warriors to take America back for Christ. But despite their best efforts, they failed, and Christendom ended. One of my goals is to convince you of something that you probably already know, which is that Christendom is really over. Not kinda over, not sort of over, over. What I'm really hoping that you'll do by the end of the paper is to not just understand it mentally, but to own it. Own it. There's a difference there. To acknowledge that those who believe in the scripture, and the second goal of my paper is to acknowledge that those who believe in the scriptures have entered a different world. Or, really, we are returning to the world that the New Testament was written into. I'm not asking you to be happy that Christendom is over. I think there is plenty to be sad about. There's plenty to be scared about. But I hope you can become convinced so that you spend your time preparing with your friends, your children, and your grandchildren to live in a world that is profoundly, profoundly different than Christendom. I grew up in Atlanta, which was in some ways straddling the fence between Christendom and post-Christendom. Rural Georgia is still Christendom. I think even to this day, rural Georgia is probably still Christendom. Atlanta is post-Christian. I remember standing in a line in North High Shoal, Georgia, waiting to pay my gas bill, and there was a guy behind me. He was kind of my age. It was a Sunday morning, and I had my church-going clothes on. And this is in rural Georgia, North High Shoals. He looked like he'd had a pretty rough night. He'd had a rough night. And I don't know if I told him that I was on my way to church or if he just recognized it by the clothes that I was wearing, but he said, yeah, I got to get back to church myself. And we talked a little bit more about that. And it was not just, this is really important, it was not just for him that he felt socially obligated to go back to church. He wanted, for his own sake, to go back to church. He felt like he was doing wrong. There was something wrong in his life, and he wanted to get back to church. That conversation would never happen in Atlanta. And I think that conversation would rarely, rarely happen in Eugene. Rarely happen in Eugene, Oregon. Maybe some places in rural Oregon. But I think what I'm arguing is that I associate Christendom with that sense that man had. I need to get back to church. It's not only expected on the outside, but it's something I want on the inside. And I'm arguing that time is largely, no, that time is over. So, I think the different experiences of myself and Jack lead us to very different conclusions about what the Christian's role in culture and society are. Whereas Jack is frustrated, sometimes even angry, at the invading army of contrabiblicists, I'm not so angry. I'm not that angry that Anderson Cooper or Nancy Pelosi or Rush Limbaugh or what's-his-name O'Reilly will endorse, acknowledge, or prefer my beliefs. I'm not angry that they will not endorse, acknowledge, or prefer my beliefs. I'm not that angry because they don't follow Christ. I don't expect anything different. I do not anymore think of them as an invading army either. I think of them as people who have been born into a world system that is sometimes hostile to Christ, that sometimes just doesn't care about Christ. Let me clarify what I mean by the world systems, because if you were raised in a very conservative home, you hear that perhaps and you think, I remember my mom telling me how evil, wretched, and horrible the world is. And that's what you're saying, Tim? Let me clarify, because I don't think that's what the Bible teaches. I think what the Bible teaches is that the Bible uses the term world, especially in the New Testament. It does not wholesale reject every aspect of the world. The world system has produced many wonderful things and many awful things. It has produced methods of purifying water, dentistry, space flight, pizza, methods of irrigating arid land, Beethoven, Socrates, mothers that love their children, schools that educate the poor, free hospitals, and LeBron James. Yes, LeBron James. So the scriptures, in referring to the world, are not rejecting pizza or Beethoven, but they are rejecting and warning against a world system that seeks glory and honor and love through the accumulation of wealth, prestige, power, and pleasure by means of greed, lust, opposition, spite, and hate. A person who follows Christ also seeks glory, honor, and love. The Christian seeks glory, honor, and love through following and imitating a suffering servant who, at the end of time, will be revealed as the King, Lord, and Judge of all creation and all people. This means those that follow Christ pursue glory, honor, and love in a means that's most easily seen in the Sermon on the Mount. Blessed are the peacemakers. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. Blessed are the merciful, the meek. We are called to be salt and light, meaning we are called to preserve good things, like salt, and offer clarity and shine light upon the bad. I understand my purpose on this earth to be a witness in deed and sometimes in word to the teaching and life of Jesus Christ. After Christendom, I'm going to tell you, after Christendom, this is the best way that I think This is how I have resolved to best do that. After Christendom, I think the best way to follow the teachings and life of Jesus Christ is to be part of a community that is a biblical alternative to the world system that I earlier described. A community that tries to embody in a shared life together Jesus' teaching as seen in the Sermon on the Mount and throughout the New Testament. They seem most clear and focused in the Sermon on the Mount. For me, that community is the faculty, right now, is the community and faculty and students of Gutenberg College. The faculty tries, sometimes with success, sometimes without success, to understand the teachings of Jesus Christ, to live those teachings with and before our students. We, the faculty, try to understand and teach about Jesus through comparing, contrasting the scriptures with the most influential and powerful and insightful books ever written. We do that with students who are sometimes curious, sometimes skeptical, sometimes eager, and sometimes antagonistic. I think, in light of the collapse of Christendom, that creating alternative communities is the way to go. Be it a church. I'm not against the church. I know there's a lot of frustration amongst a lot of you about churches that you've been part of. I've been part of very good churches in the past, so I'm not afraid to say, go back to church, make it a good church. So by creating alternative communities, I mean church, I mean friends who share what you believe, I mean wherever. So that's the preface. That's not the preface. That's where I'm coming from. That's kind of my conviction. I'm not after saving a slice of American cultural life. I'm about being a Christian, and in many ways that is distinct and different from many things in American culture. I will start now trying to contrast my view with Jack's argument. And what I'm going to do is I'm just going to try to open my mind up and just tell you exactly how I try to make a decision, let's say, about a particular piece of legislation or about a particular cultural event or about a particular legislator that I might vote for. That's what I'm going to try to do. I'm just going to try to give you a snapshot of the way that I think about it. First, let me try to contrast it with what Jack argues in his paper. Jack argues that there's a superior class who are contra-biblicists in imposing their will upon America and rapidly making it an anti-Christian state. A Christ follower who supports this movement is either, number one, confused, or number two, not really a Christ follower. I think that Jack's view presupposes a purity in politics that, after Christendom, does not and cannot exist. It suggests a means of evaluating candidates, cultural issues, political issues, and trends that is either or. Either you are with us, the biblicist, or against us, the contra-biblicist. Obviously, Jack's going to respond to this, and he can clarify if I've misunderstood him. I think that advocating that view in the political arena suppresses complexity drastically. I think that by applying that simple rubric, either contra-biblicism or biblicism, runs in danger of making Christians enemy of common justice. And so let me explain what I mean by two examples. First, this is a headline I picked almost at random from the newspaper last week. An American woman living in a Muslim-dominated country, I think it was Saudi Arabia, was raped and then put on trial in that country for illegal sexual contact. The United States government heard about the woman's trial and engaged in sharp negotiations to extract her from the country and to bring her back home. I consider that decision by the United States government to be a just action. Furthermore, I think that God smiled upon that action. The trouble is, it was performed almost entirely by contra-biblicists. The story was broken by the New York Times and by ambassadors that were appointed by our very leftist president. I feel quite confident that Jack would agree that extracting the poor woman from that unjust court in that country was a just and good act. I feel confident that Jack would support such an effort. What I am not as confident about is that Jack's political rubric, as advocated in his paper, could acknowledge that contra-biblicists acted in a biblical manner. Obviously, he'll have a chance to respond. He can say more about it. I suspect what Jack will say is, yes, they acted in a biblical manner, but their hearts had other motivations than serving the God of the Bible. To which I respond, fine, so long as that woman is out of Saudi Arabia. Let me give you another example of how I think Jack's view suppresses complexity and potentially makes Christians the enemy of common justice. My senior year in high school, there was a rumor going around my history class that Kevin Button was gay. Kevin Button was a short, kind of a nerdy-looking guy who really loved history, and he wore white button-down shirts. He did not match my picture of gay, which was, like, I don't know, painted fingernails. I had not met any gay people. But I just didn't believe that Kevin Button was gay. He didn't look gay. And furthermore, I didn't think that gay people existed in Lilburn, Georgia. I just didn't think it happened. My girlfriend and I went to prom my senior year with a couple of other people. And I looked up ahead of us in the line to wait to get our pictures. And there I saw Kevin Button wearing his black tuxedo and his black tie. And I saw him standing next to what appeared to be maybe his boyfriend, but I just couldn't believe it. They get up to the person taking the camera, taking the pictures, the one with the camera. And she said, hey, where are your dates? And they said, we are each other's dates. We came together. And she said, no, I mean, like the girls you came with. What do you mean? I mean, you know, where are they? Kevin, no, we came with each other. We are a couple. And it took a long process of negotiation for the woman to say, oh, but you're two boys. Yes, we are. And so finally, it was kind of a funny moment in retrospect. The woman positioned Kevin Button and her boyfriend, so they were standing like this, and there's about 6 inches of space between them. It was just the most awkward-looking picture you can imagine, because you could tell, am I allowed to? She was wondering, am I allowed to let them hold hands? What am I allowed to do? About 2 hours later, my girlfriend and I and our friends were about 50 feet from the dance floor. And we heard this screaming and yelling inside on the dance floor. So we go in there to look at what was going on. And Kevin Button and his boyfriend were dancing. And around them were about 60 or 70 members of, well, it looked like the entire football team. And they were screaming. They were screaming the most awful, unrepeatable things that you can possibly imagine at them. Vile, despicable things. And I am very confident that if there were not adults around, Kevin Button and his boyfriend would have been beaten. Beaten badly, too. A few years after that happened, contrabiblicists introduced hate crimes legislation to stiffen the penalties for violent acts motivated by hatred of a specific group, in this case, homosexuals. Conservatives marshaled three arguments against it. I'm just going to tell you what those arguments were, and then I'm going to tell you about how I thought about those arguments and how I continue to think about those arguments. Conservatives said the difficulty of assessing motivations of hate in criminal trials make it virtually impossible to actually say, yes, that is a hate crime. No, that is not a hate crime. So that's one counterargument against hate crimes legislation. They further argued that the U.S. should not supply special status, special legal protection to certain groups. That's argument number two against hate crimes legislation. Number three, legislation was being pushed by the homosexual lobby, read contrabiblicists, in another effort to normalize homosexuality. So here's how I thought about those three arguments. The first argument actually made sense to me. I can imagine it being very difficult to assess whether or not somebody is motivated by hate or not. So I thought, okay, that may be a strike against hate crimes legislation. The second argument, that the U.S. should not supply special status or special legal protection to certain groups, that argument was less compelling to me. The government was not giving special status to homosexuals willy-nilly, but special status to homosexuals because of a pattern of violent people injuring them, singling them out. Hate crimes legislation, if you recall, was introduced after Matthew Shepard was tied to a Wyoming fence post, pistol whipped, and tortured until he died. The third argument, was that the homosexual lobby were trying to normalize homosexuality in mainstream America. This might have been true. Perhaps the contrabiblicists were trying to normalize homosexuality, but my goals in the political realm were not to maintain a quasi-Christian state or culture. They are not to merely protect Christians and Christians' belief, but I hope that I live in a government that tries to protect all people, particularly those that suffer violence habitually against them. I think that the government should avenge those who practice evil and defend those who practice good. I took that from Romans 13. I think the boys who tortured Matthew Shepard practiced evil. Despite the counter-arguments against hate crimes legislation, if I had to vote for it up or down, I would have voted for it. Does hate crimes legislation help normalize homosexuality? Yes, it might have. I thought that protecting Kevin Button was more important than that. I have been speaking as someone born after Christendom. I suspect that if you are over 50, you think about these things very differently. When I say abortion, perhaps those of you over 50 are more likely to think about political and cultural issues. When I say abortion, you think Roe versus Wade, Planned Parenthood, a piece of Texas legislation. When I hear abortion, I think Julie. I have seen what it has done to Julie. The sharp, quiet sadness that she carries with her, and the regret that she carries. And I wish more than anything that no more abortions were performed ever. But my sadness and frustration are directed primarily here, not here. Does that make any sense? I am suspicious about what happens here. I'm just suspicious that, well, never mind, I've said enough about that. I suspect if those of you are over 50, when you hear homosexuality, you might first think gay marriage bill, Barney Frank, or something Sean Hannity said last week. When I think about homosexuality, I think about my friends Kevin, Michael, Paul. I'm just trying to let you look into my mind and let you know how I think about these things. I immediately think about relationships that I have, and I secondarily think about this upper story of culture politics. I feel a constant tug of war in myself between this ideological level and the personal level. You might say to me, Tim, that conflict is resolved by loving the sinner and hating the sin. I agree, and I think that tagline, love the sinner, hate the sin, is actually a very good way to summarize the biblical approach to such things. But as David mentioned yesterday, when to stand against moral erosion, when to forsake stating my ideological approach for the sake of not poisoning the well, that is a very, very difficult decision to make. The decision is complicated. The decision is furthermore complicated because of a legacy of evangelical ideological engagement. I don't know how much Toby talked about this, but I'm just going to talk about it very briefly. As some of you know, I write and act in plays. I have lots of theater friends in Eugene who have no affiliation with Christianity. If I said to them, I am a Christian, they will hear, I hate gay people. That is what they will hear. Do you think that I exaggerate? I do not exaggerate. Do you think that they have fallen prey to the anti-Christian media? I don't think they've fallen prey to the anti-Christian media, because I hear evangelicals say such things with their own mouth. There was a poll that asked, I think it was 1 week ago, what do you think of evangelical Christians? The most popular answer, 85%, they hate gay people. I don't think that is mere media propaganda that people think that. I think propaganda helps reinforce the notion that Christians hate gay people. I don't think that all evangelicals hate gay people. But I think that there is a heavy, heavy cost for evangelical Christians operating so heavily up here. I'll give you one other example of how operating up here can so easily distract a person from just living a godly life. I used to work in politics, as a lot of you guys know. I had a friend that worked at a place called the Family Research Council. I'm not sure if you guys know about the Family Research Council. So one of the biggest, strongest evangelical political organizations that I know of. I called my friend. We were just talking about other business, but I mentioned to him an interview that I had seen with a guy from Family Research Council. He was being interviewed, I think, maybe on the Today Show. I think it was by Bryant Gumbel. The guy was from Family Research Council, was advocating for such and such, a conservative political idea. And he was clearly frustrating Bryant Gumbel. So they were about to go to a commercial break, and Bryant Gumbel, just before the cameras shut off, turned to one of his friends and just cursed the guy. He said, "Fucking asshole! Cameras shut off." So I was calling my friend, and because I had heard that Family Research Council was demanding an apology from Bryant Gumbel. And I asked my friend, I said, "Is that true?" And he said, "Well, yeah. I mean, yeah, it is true. The guy owes us an apology." And I said, "Boy, isn't this an opportunity to, like, do exactly what Jesus taught us to do? Bless those who curse you. Bless those who curse you." And he said, "But Tim, you don't understand. Bryant Gumbel cursed him." I said, "What don't I understand? What do I not understand about this? I saw the interview." But there was a motivation for FRC. The motivation was to score political points with their people by demanding an apology and by showing how awful and against us they are. So it's sort of given an excuse to kind of just not do what Jesus said to do. Okay. Imagine I just decided, sorry, that was just kind of a riff, that story. I'm going back to the 85% of people responded that evangelicals hate or reject gay people. Can you imagine how different, how profoundly different our world would be if the number one answer was, those are the people that love their enemies, right? Aren't those the people that tend to love their enemies? Those are the people that tend to adopt orphans and foster care children and volunteer at hospitals. I know those people. How different that our world would be if those were the top responses. So, last page. What's the takeaway? Those of you over 50 have choices to make where you will spend your time and your money and your effort. I'm going to get personal now. You can listen to Sean Hannity and Rush Limbaugh and what's-his-name O'Reilly lambasting the liberals, or you can listen to James Earl Jones' recording of Paul's epistles. Paul's epistles were written to Christ followers living as a maligned religious community in an alien empire under a pagan emperor. You can encourage young people to return to a world that you grew up in, or you can share your wisdom and help us prepare to live in a world that we live in. Those of you under 40 have a choice to make too. You can nurse your frustration at evangelical politicos and churches, and you can use your frustrations as a distraction to not really follow God. Or you can light a candle and carefully carry it into the wind and dare to be an emissary for God's truth and God's love. Questions?
I totally appreciate the anecdote, the riff, and the problem that we have when we recognize that there's something that needs to be responded to, and we respond badly. We return evil for evil. What I would like you to do is tell me how this perspective, this is a genuine question. Sometimes I ask questions that I think I know the answers to, but I don't know the answer to this one. What is the difference between returning, bless those that curse us, and being nice? Jesus was not a nice guy. He called people generation of vipers and that kind of thing. On the other hand, there were times that he was very gentle. There were times that he was very pointed. What is the difference between what we should do and just simply being nice, rolling over, playing dead, saying, oh, you want to kill your baby. Gee, I know you must be under a lot of pressure. And, you know, leave it at that.
Yeah. I'll just try to open up my head and just let you know the little rubric that I walk through. One of the first questions that I would ask is this person that I'm having a conversation with, is this person a Christian? Is this person decidedly following Christ? Is that what they're about? I think if the answer to that question is yes, it seems like the scriptures encourage us to be most direct and unnice with them. We share the same values. We share the same beliefs. This is not living by those. Now, let's imagine it's somebody outside the Christian fold. Do you see how different like my answers are for these two things? And I think it's all over the New Testament that there are just different rules for Christians and different rules for the rest of the world. Jesus and Paul did not expect the rest of the world to conform to what we believe. They want them to eventually, and they know they will eventually. But in the here and now, there's a warning against judging the world. That's God's job, not our job. So let's imagine that I'm having that conversation about abortion with a friend of mine who has no Christian inklings whatsoever. I believe that life is sacred, and I believe that having an abortion will hurt her. Hurt her, I don't know about physically, it can be done safe. I think it will hurt her forever, psychologically and emotionally. So I would say, I would be very, very nice to her because she's not going in to have an abortion because she just wants to kill a child. She's got something else pressing against her. Maybe it's pressure from parents. Maybe it's pressure from boyfriend. Maybe it's just that she doesn't want to. This is not part of her plan. And so I would be very nice with her, and I would just tell her what I expect would happen if she goes through with it. And I think what will happen if she goes through with it will not be, it will be singularly unpleasant, and she'll have for the rest of her life.
Okay, so how do we? One of the messages we're supposed to take to non-Christians, and it is to say repent, and to talk about the stakes. What's at stake if you don't repent? By definition, we're not talking to Christians when we do that, or to Christians who aren't acting very Christianly and need to be reminded. So must the message, it seems to me there's a bit of a contradiction if we try to be nice and say repent. Mm-hmm. So how do we tell non-Christians to repent? Now, I will agree that not all of us are called to bring that message to the world. To our people, to our neighbors, maybe, but not necessarily to the world. But those of us who are called to bring that message to the world, how do we do that and not be not nice?
What is the goal of saying repent? Tell me what you understand the goal of saying repent to be.
To let people know that there are consequences for particular attitudes, that there are consequences to certain behaviors, but behaviors themselves are not what loses you, what makes you worthy of eternal death. It's your attitudes about your behaviors and your other attitudes and that kind of thing. So I would say, warning, look, you can only continue this so long, and at some point you're going to meet the judge, the creator of the universe.
Right.
And he will either be happy with you or not happy with you.
Right.
You want him to be happy with you.
And are you asking, you're saying that you cannot do that and be nice. And I agree with that. That's just part of loving somebody demands sometimes you're not nice.
Meaning I'm not going to pull any punches. But on the other hand, there are definitely wrong ways to do that.
Yeah.
I would definitely agree to say, oh, you're disgusting and I'm not.
Yeah.
That's a problem.
Yeah.
So you're not saying that we don't necessarily be pointed with people, be very frank with people, actually come out and tell them things that don't sound very nice.
Right.
We're not always warm and cuddly. We can be very pointed, but there's a point at which being pointed becomes abusive, becomes unloving, becomes self-righteous, becomes my attitude shouts so loudly that they can't hear what I'm saying.
Right. Right. Am I hearing you right, Margaret? I think I'm understanding what you're saying. You want me to respond to something?
I'm just wondering, it sounded, I'm sure from knowing you, I'm sure you would make a distinction between what you are implying we should do and niceness. You're not saying we should be nice. So I guess I would like you to clarify what you're saying we should be. If you're not saying we ought to be nice, when we're not nice, that's wrong. That's inherently wrong.
Oh. I'm sorry. I don't remember. I didn't say we should be nice.
No, I know you didn't. That's why I want you to clarify, because somebody could interpret what you said as, well, we should just be nice. It wasn't nice for them to stand around and yell terrible things at them. I guess what I think you might say is, when the football players did that, it wasn't wrong because it wasn't nice. It was wrong because it wasn't loving. Mm-hmm. And those are different things.
Mm-hmm.
So the difference between nice and between being loving?
Oh, the choice is always to be loving.
What's the difference, though?
Knowing who you're talking to seems like a vital part of it. Knowing what that person is living by and wants to live by is another thing that's important. And whether or not the egregiousness of the action demands that you be forceful and not be nice.
Or maybe, what is your aim? Is your aim to do good for them? To promote what's best for them? Is your aim to hurt them?
Okay, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good.
I like what you said. However, I can't agree with the way you got to any of it, which is hard for me. I'm having this sort of, I have an intellectual ping pong ball bouncing around in my head right now. It seems like your defense or support for the place you stand is that someone got their feelings hurt. It's that either you had a negative experience, or a friend of yours had a negative experience, or someone else had a negative experience. And therefore, that's how we determine whether what happened to them was right or wrong, and how that should affect our view. And I think that's the same problem you have. The only way to forgive Bryant Gumbel was to hold him accountable for his behaviors. If he didn't do anything wrong, if our forgiveness is not forgiving anything wrong, then it's worthless. I would have taken a different tack. I probably would have gone on my public relations response would be, yeah, Brian lost his cool. He revealed his heart. He shared a personal opinion in a position where that was not his role. It's not an unforgivable sin. We understand. We're not holding it against him. That, would have been a beautiful way to do it, rather than, you're right, making political hay out of it. But we have to acknowledge that what he did was terrible. An abuse of his position and not a way you treat another human being. Especially before millions of, viewers. And that's tough. The Matthew Shepard story was a hoax. And I'm sorry, but my source is CBS News, investigative reports. Matthew Shepard was a methamphetamine dealer who was known to carry methamphetamine and large amounts of cash. The two boys that took him and killed him had been up for at least 3 days without sleep, under the influence of meth, and knew where they could get some. And according to their investigation, he didn't have any on him that night. So they took his money and they beat him to death and went on to do other things. That was a drug crime, which was touted as a homosexual assault. Incidentally, one of the boys was revealed to have been a homosexual in jail. Again, that was horrible. But that was a drug crime. Any crime is a hate crime. Every crime is a hate crime. You don't commit crime against people because you love them, because you adore them. You don't steal from them because they don't have enough. But I agree with you. This constant reference to homosexuality is the epitome of the sin that human beings need to to identify as the ground where we debate is just absurd. We say it's not any worse than the other sin, yet it's the one we keep referring to through this whole conference. We don't talk about the capitalist who engages in capitalism as a cover for his greed. I think capitalism is wonderful and good. But let's face it, a lot of people champion it because they're greedy, avaricious, and they love power. But you're right. We must love those who curse us. And we must forgive those who despitefully use us. Whether or not we need to do that in public, I don't know. But I do agree with Anya that. But you see, I get there in a different way. When I read polls that say 85-95% of people said, yeah, Christians, those are people that hate gays. Have you read the poll? Have you looked at the sample? You know, I go downtown here in Eugene and I ask them that question. And I give them three responses. They hate gays. They give more money to charitable organizations than anyone else in the history of the world. They volunteer in numbers far outside their percentage of the population. I give them those three choices. What are they going to do? Those weren't the three, four, or five choices that were given them. And that would not be a sampling of the population at large. But you're right. We have allowed the media to persuade the general population that that's who we are. Even though at 57 years old, I have never met an evangelical who said they hate gays. Ever. Ever, ever, ever. And when I went to my class reunion and a friend of ours brought her lesbian girlfriend there, we danced with them. We were a little uncomfortable. Not a name was called. And that was in southern Indiana. All right, so different experience. No one got their feelings hurt, but had they done it, I would have stepped in. So, again, I agree with everything you think we should do and should be. Totally different reasons. We do not go to, I think, consequentialism to determine morality. You tell me the story about Julie, incidentally my sister's name, who drank herself to death. I will tell you the story about Lorraine. When I knew her at the U of O, last time I checked, she'd had three abortions. Didn't care. She wasn't upset. Because while her boyfriend, her fiancé, was going to West Point, she was doing what she wanted. And it got inconvenient, and that was her opinion. It's inconvenient. It's an accident. It seems to me, if I had known where she was going with that, I would have sat and pleaded with her not to do that. Not because of the consequences. Those are escapable. I can tell you a story of another friend who actually had those consequences and explained them away as normal and healthy. Bizarre. But I would have said, Lorraine, what you're doing is wrong. What you're doing is evil. What you're doing is destroying life. That becomes the ground and the platform where I can tell her who God is. That's wrong because of who God is and his love for you. It's not wrong because it will hurt your feelings. You can fix that. We have a pill for that. And we've got new pills, in fact, that will erase your emotional experience of the event so that you don't remember it emotionally.
I don't think that abortion is wrong because the consequences.
Okay.
I think it's wrong because God says it's wrong. My friend Julie has no idea of that. She has no shared conviction about that. If I make an argument to Julie that what she's about to do is evil and morally wrong because God despises it, she is gone. Gone.
Never. I wasn't. I wasn't.
You weren't. I know my friend Julie. She's gone. I would make a consequentialist argument for her because that's the one that I think she'd hear. That's the only reason.
But is it the truth?
Yes, it's the truth that it will hurt her for the rest of her life. Is it? Do you think that's not true?
It depends on the person, and I can't know her future. I don't have a crystal ball, and I don't know how she's going to react to it and deal with it. We have had a woman in our community here who cried every year on the anniversary of her abortion. But my friend Lorraine had no such response.
Sure. She's different from Julie.
I know. But the truth, see, that's my point. The truth is the same. And morality is the same. And God is the same. And I can see how we can tailor our vocabulary in telling the truth, but I don't think we should ever leave the truth out.
Agreed.
And like I say, I really, really like it, the heads up call to be to listen to the Sermon on the Mount, to listen to those injunctions against hate and revenge. I just have difficulty with listening how you got there. I don't think it addresses the worldview that Jack is talking about in his paper. You know, that God is God and good is good, and that's reality.
Do you hear me saying that that is not reality? Did I at any point in the paper say that that's not reality? Or did I even imply that it was not reality?
Well, okay, the Matthew Shepard thing was not reality. That's why I have...
Let me clarify that. Yeah. The reason I was inclined to believe in the Matthew Shepard story is because I had that experience with Kevin Budden.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was not a surprise to me to think that something like that did happen.
Me too.
So I may have been duped by the media.
Yeah.
Right. I may have been. Nonetheless, nonetheless, I had enough of a personal experience that I thought, yeah, that thing happens. That does happen. And I think it happens pretty frequently. So whether or not the guy got the Matthew Shepard story right or not doesn't undermine my confidence that homosexual people were treated very poorly, often violently.
I might be reacting. My wife is a registered Choctaw, and we just attended the Choctaw gathering about 2 weeks ago. And when they talked about the Trail of Tears, they used the very same excuses that they heard from the government that you gave to the woman having the abortion. Now, I don't want to punish her in this life for what she did. But the Choctaw and my ancestry, the Cherokee, were inconvenient. And they were not people. And Jackson had a lot of pressure on him. The same words you used to defend, or to explain, I should say, her choices. And millions of people were marched to their death in a genocidal war with those very same excuses. So I agree with you.
Those very same excuses.
That they were inconvenient. That they were under a lot of pressure, that they were not people. And that's what you said. That may be what she was going through. And so you can understand why she would make that decision. And I said, those same words come up every time someone wants to justify doing a horrible thing. And I don't think you're saying it in quite the same vein.
I don't think I am either.
But I think it is the same thing. If I'm going to have emotional distress, loss of status, loss of income, inconvenience, what is that in comparison to a human life? Isn't that really the argument we should offer someone like that? And the fact that we can't, that we don't feel we have permission, that has become unchristlike. I need to be maybe schooled in that. I think that's my response. I'm saying that's all. But again, I agree with every place you stand.
Logan, did you hear me? Did I at any point say, "Hey, Julie, you ought to go have that abortion. I don't want to be unkind."
No.
Okay, I didn't say that. I was merely trying to reflect the sort of argument that I would give to her so that she'd keep her baby. And the reason I chose that argument is because it's one that I thought she would hear. If I used the argument that you just used as an example, she would not hear me. She'd be gone. The truth has not changed.
You're saying, I'm not going to tell you this as a person. I'm not going to tell you stand before God. In your mind, you're saying this to yourself. What I'm going to say is...
Julie doesn't believe in God.
Right. Okay, fine. That's my point. We're going to use a consequentialist argument, a personal plea, in the hopes that she will save her baby, and somewhere down the road, God will come to her and give her the truth, and she'll be saved, right?
Yeah.
Okay, that's salesmanship. That's not truth, I think. I think that's manipulation. I think that's, I'm not going to tell you the truth because you won't accept it. I'll sell you what you want. What you'll buy in the hopes that I can sell you the truth later. Does that, I mean, am I...
Julie help? Knows I'm a Christian. She knows what my convictions are. No, it's not salesmanship.
Okay.
That Matthew Shepard thing, that was where the gay man was beat up, right? I wasn't aware of all the arguments in that situation, but I remember it vaguely. And I agreed with everything you said about it, but I end up on the other side of the issue. And it was more emotional. I don't think I was siding with evangelicals. Mm-hmm. It seemed to me that it was setting the table for a group of people in the future to look at an action I've done and judge me maybe much more harshly than someone else that's done the same action because they've looked at my motive.
Mm-hmm. And that for me was the strongest argument against it. So I share that with you.
So we do. So I'm not sure why that's not strong enough, because the people that beat Matthew Shepard to death, there are laws that probably could put them away forever.
Right.
Those laws exist based on what the act that they've done. And maybe I don't understand the legal system, but I think that we do as much as we can to go away from judging the motives of people. We do when we need to, but I think it's only when we need to. And I'm speaking off the... I don't know anything about the legal system. So
I agree with you. The way that you're reasoning about it is the exact same way that I reasoned about it. And so I kind of came up with I was in a little bit of a pickle. I thought, it seems like this piece of legislation would do a lot to protect homosexuals from being beat up. On the other hand, it establishes this kind of legal precedent in which people are judged for like the motives of like hate and whether or not there's hate. And I'm suspicious that the legal system could really do a very good job of that, or that it would do it really effectively. So I had to make a judgment call, because this part is a strike against it, this before it, and I made my best call. My best call was, I think that despite the faulty piece of legislation, I think it would protect gay people, so I think I'll support it.
So I guess, I mean, we ended up on different sides. I guess I'm not disregarding any of your points, but given the fact that Matthew Shepard we do have a way to prosecute that crime to the extent and give those people what we can. I mean, only God ultimately can give people what they deserve. I think the justice system is basically crowd control when it comes down to it. So I landed on the other side because I know men, and I know they aren't just. And I think it's a much, much greater danger for us to go down a path where we suggest to each other through our legal system that we now can judge each other in that fashion.
Right.
And I think that runs against not Christianity, but the very foundations of our legal system, if I understand it right. I think to do that would be an anomaly, to go against the very foundation and principles.
Right.
But that's my own impression. I don't know anything about the law.
And again, I want to say I had the exact same train of thought as you. And I understand that train of thought. And it was very compelling for me. It was a dilemma. And I chose the other side. But just a little bit more evidence for me was on the other side.
Hey, I don't actually have a question. I just wanted to say that I appreciate your up here, down here distinction. I think that I cannot begin to explain how difficult it is for me to engage with anything up here. And I find that your appeal to down here was very smart, because it allows me, especially where I'm coming from, to hear a lot of what I actually dialogue with. Because I especially don't understand the dialogue up here, and I especially don't seem to have that dialogue even play out in my human experience whatsoever at all.
You don't feel it play out in your human experience?
Yeah, I don't. I don't readily even know how to recognize it, except people keep talking on this level. And I see them talking about it, but I just can't figure out the connection, because that riff that's there it's just there. And there seems to be such a disconnect between the two, I can't. So I just want to say I very much appreciate that, and I appreciate your identifying down here and articulating so well what I'm constantly actually thinking about and what I'm constantly actually, like, battling. I really appreciate that.
Eric, for the sake of us slower people, could you give a synopsis of the distinction?
Of what? I guess how I'm understanding this and this is there. It seems there are two dialogues to be had about a particular issue, and one can approach that from a I think the conversation they just had about the it usually starts with some sort of
particular piece of legislation, hate crimes legislation up here.
Mm-hmm. Yes, which I have what seems like very little access to, partially due to my education, lack of a father, etc. Who knows why the reason I can't touch that, but I have no idea what they just talked about. However, the down here part, where we talk about the way we ought maybe treat people in America, like the people, how I ought treat the person next to me, I can relate to that one. I can at least work with that one. There's some sort of dialogue there. And so I particularly saw Tim's opening up to Julie and other people in his life, not merely as a way of ignoring the top. I think I assume that he, like I, knows that that's where I can address things. And the reason he kept referring to his internal process is because he's trying to help open up a world that I know really well, which is there's some top stuff. Okay. And then there's some bottom stuff, and that I know what that I know about. You need a microphone. We're really across the room.
The part that I don't understand is, what are we supposed to do with the up here? Okay, either of you, what were you arguing we need to do with the up here? Ignore it or?
No, I'm not suggesting that we ignore it. I'm saying when I go and I hang out with my theater friends, I put a lot of what I would do up here in my back pocket.
I cannot imagine any reasonable Christian not doing that.
Right.
Me neither, Jeff.
Emphasis on reasonable, right?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, we all know Christian jerks. So, yeah, I mean, there's always been people who have violated that. But it seems to me that evangelicals, conservative, right-wing, whatever, it's been assumed that they don't like people. And that's never, I'm with Logan, that's never been my, or somebody else who said, my whole life experience. I've run into a handful of people, but with all of my criticism of evangelicals and Christendom and all that kind of stuff, I like the people. I think for the most part, they're incredibly decent, loving, kind, gracious people. They're sinners. They're making their way through life, bumbling their way through life. But I just the picture of them as being haters just does not match my experience. And going out of their way to make contact with people where they are, that was always what they trained me to do. That's what they always told me to do. I just think that's exactly right. But I don't understand the undercurrent of this is new and novel and something the older people don't understand.
I'm not asserting that it's new and novel either. I think just what you said, we are constantly kind of like facing that decision about whether or not to speak up about the things that are up here amongst people that we know disagree with us about things up here. I think increasingly, because I am less devoted to saving America or Christianizing America or something like that, I'm more inclined to put these things in my back pocket and more inclined to sacrifice them for what's down here. And when I was giving the whole distinction of like up here, down here, this is the way that I think about things, I was just trying to give an x-ray of the way that I think about things to try to show what I think is maybe a difference between you and I or just people that are over 50 and under 40. That was just... So, when you raised the issue of, you should oppose hate crimes legislation for this reason, I could very easily imagine somebody convincing me of that for the reasons that you mentioned. I can also imagine never telling anybody about it.
Okay. I'm thinking of hate crime legislation, anti-bullying laws, campaigns, curricula in school. My best guess is that far more people are affected by bullies attacking them for their weight or for their developmental disabilities, things that don't really fit into the mainstream narrative in the media. That doesn't draw attention the way bullying somebody because they're gay or because they're black. A hate crime where six black teenagers shoot, I think it was a 1 or 2 year old baby in the face, and shoot the mother as well. And they decide that's not a hate crime. The whole idea of, I guess I'm just reinforcing, when we've gone to the place where you as a judge can, or as a jury, can determine what you think my motivation was, I'm lost. I'm in Kafka's world.
I think we try to assess. I should have never brought up hate crimes legislation. I was not meaning to make the centerpiece of my talk an advocacy for hate crimes legislation.
Okay.
Not my goal at all.
Well, I wonder.
Just trying to expose. This is just the way that I think about it.
Yeah. I like a whole lot of what you said. It's an area that I think about. And because the microphone was near and because the topic was there, I flipped the mental coin and I went for it. And I
really appreciate the up here political media and down here one-on-one relationships. And I think that's particularly what Toby was talking about in his previous speech, was how he didn't know how to deal with up here. And it was just other things going on. I just lost it. I totally lost it.
This is a cry for help. I felt really skewered by Toby's presentation and my utter ignorance in approaching this whole issue of the difference, generation difference, cultural differences. And to use Jack's word, I've heard him say that several times. And I just read a chapter out of C.S. Lewis's book, and he was talking about connivance. And Patricia and I have a number of gay people in our family, and we also have gay friends. And I just feel completely inadequate in knowing. C.S. Lewis talked about the problem that we have in kind of going along with the crowd when we're with the crowd, laughing at their jokes. My cry for help is, I really don't know how to walk that line. We love them, we care for them, we're interested in them. We want to do everything that we can do to be available as Christians to present the truth if there is an opportunity. But I have to confess that walking that line is just so, so difficult. I'm 78 years old. And obviously there's a significant gap there, age-wise, cultural-wise, all kinds of wise. So this is just a cry for your prayers. I'm not asking for an answer from you. I know that God will give us the wisdom, but boy, do I feel out in left field somehow in the process. I guess I feel like maybe, I don't know how Lot felt down there in Sodom and Gomorrah, but it kind of feels that way to me. I'm not afraid of this environment. I just don't know. I don't know where to go with it. And I just would ask for prayer. It's a cry for help.
I think that that feeling, I'm going to suppose that I understand that feeling. I think that's the way everybody under a certain age feels all the time. Thanks for saying that.
Sides of the thing.
Yeah. I would love to make it easier on myself. I would love to make it easier on myself. And there are ready-made categories out there that I can just put on and apply. And I just don't think that those ready-made categories, I think they just suppress complexity. Same.
So I wrote it down this time. So up here, political media. Down here, individual relationships. I think what I hear you saying, and I think I'm pretty sure this is what Toby's saying and what Eric's saying, is why would we deal with up here? These two guys don't even know what it is exactly or how to deal with it. They only know how to deal with down here. And I think you said early on in your talk that you were super leery about dealing with up here because you weren't sure, you couldn't control up here like you can control down here.
Yeah.
You couldn't see as clearly.
Yeah.
I think what the older generation is saying, has been saying in this conference, is that Christianity is losing its foothold up here. And politically and mediologically and stuff, we don't have power up here anymore. We're losing our sway. And they're afraid of this because it brings instability to the country, and it's scary to raise a family in a culture which is anti-Christian. The younger generation is not scared of this because they're afraid of the cultural seduction of political Christianity.
I think it's spot on. Yeah, I think it's exactly right. That was my speech.
Yeah, so the question is then, the older generation wants to deal with up here. We've got to deal with up here. This is what Jack's been doing all of his life, campus crusade and all that kind of stuff. So he's like, we gotta keep up here going. Where the younger generation is like, up here? Why would we deal with up here?
Yeah, I think that's true. And so to those under 40, I say, this up here matters. Those over 50, I say, this is not the sum total of your Christian involvement. It cannot be.
So you're advocating the medium way.
I'm advocating the medium way, which is the messy way.
I have to say the level of misunderstanding to me is stunning. I mean stunning. And I mean I love saying him to death, but to suggest Jack has ever been in Campus Crusade or that he has in any way focused virtually any of his life on this. I mean, I've known Jack for 30 years, and I'm thinking, over the last 5 years, I'm thinking, Jack actually has some interest in political things. He's never been in. I mean, that. So the level of misunderstanding to me is amazing. When you talk about the up here and the down here.
Clarify one thing first.
Sure.
Just because I've heard these two guys have political conversations in the classroom, and I think Sam was still in school when Jam started getting more interested in politics. So I understand what Sam is saying. I think Jack has gotten more interested in things up here, not exclusively.
Oh yeah, he has in the last 5 years.
Always been into that, and I didn't realize that it's not always.
I see.
And so back to the up here, down here. To me, that distinction is not helpful because what seems to me to be behind what I'm hearing in making that distinction is that somehow or other, my concern about what's up here is quite devoid of any life down here, as if I don't have anyone close to me who's gay. As if I haven't had abortion close to my household or divorce. I mean, as if somehow or other I'm and I said, not to be personal, I didn't appreciate this morning your dismissing me when I didn't want to speak for my generation. I spoke of myself, but I don't think I'm the only one feeling that way. So for me, for my generation, seemingly it feels to me as though I am being dismissed, we are being dismissed, as somehow or other cold, dispassionate, or, you know, again, Sam's characterization is though all I'm interested in politics is in politics and in power. And I mean, give me a break. I am interested in my children, my children's friends. I cannot tell you how much time, emotional energy I expend in trying to understand my kids and their generation. I go to their movies, I read their books, many of which I love, many of which I understand, and they grab me. I mean, that's what motivates me. And so to suggest that somehow or other we are just clueless and heartless, and all we're concerned about is political power and legislation, I mean, to me, that betrays such unbelievable misunderstanding about who I am, who we are, and what motivates us. And I thought maybe we were going to be making some progress on opening the lines of dialogue. And when I hear the distinction reinforced, you're that way. I mean, especially when I hear that Jack was in Campus Crusade. And I mean, when I hear those distinctions reinforced, you're that way and we're this way, and the insistence that until we admit that we're wrong, that there's no dialogue to be had, boy, I hear that and I say, I don't even know where to start anymore. I mean, other than with my own kids, who love me, and some of their friends who love me because my kids love me. Where do I start? Because there is such an insistence that we are wrong and that we don't understand and that we are simply cold-hearted, political power-mongering people. Don't even know where to start.
Peter, you're a dear fella. Don't get me wrong. And the whole, my point was, the whole reason that you guys are particularly interested in up here is because for the safety of your family and your children and the way their children are going to grow up, you don't want them to grow up in a society which is tyrannizing them. And that is the whole reason you guys are particularly interested in up here. So it is not for power and it is not for control or anything like that. It is because you care for Jem and all the rest of your children. So I think you must have misheard me right there. It's written down on my napkin if you want to know.
So we definitely have two experiences that are happening. I mean, we have two. It seems to mark out generationally. Jack's explanation of why he has never experienced the kind of negativity we are describing out of evangelical Christianity is mostly because Jack has never had an abortion. And so what I'm trying to explain is I think the unity of evangelicals is not all negative. The political manifestations of it are how we have interpreted it. We have seen it as a political force. And therefore, it was tyrannizing in so much that political forces can be tyrannizing. Do we think individual evangelicals are especially hideous? Well, besides the guilt trippiness for not being... Jack told a story about socks once. Do you remember the story about socks? Public school, though. What a great reason why you said that. Jack has a story where you didn't wear socks, you did wear socks. You hadn't been wearing socks. And then the next day, they did an announcement. How did that make you feel? If you don't mind, I'll retell it. Jack, how old are you? So this would have been 1923. And so, Jack is a senior in high school. Jack proceeds for a week, a few days, maybe doesn't do the laundry, to not wear socks. And at some point in that week or in the next following week, on a day he happened to wear socks, there was an announcement, by the way, wear socks. Jack clarifies and goes, but that was a public high school. So Artie and Jack mind is saying, but the oppression is coming from the public high school. The oppression is coming from the... No, but for our generation, the oppression has come, in some sense, from both sides. But the oppression and what Jack experienced, we've experienced about every nuance of moral decision we could make, every element of personal style. And then I watched this, and this happened about Julie. We're in this paradigm where we don't have what you guys have. And to slap our hands for not having the base assumptions of it, it's just fruitless. It's not like you can't do it. You can do it all day long. How's it working out for you guys? Like, I'm not saying you are inherently wrong. I'm not saying that your heart is somehow broken or you're a terribly, terrible person. I'm saying that from our experience, the remarkable thing you could do is apologize for the tyranny that has been going on in our childhood and lives. Now, are you personally responsible for the tyranny? No. But identifying that the tyranny there will get you is the key. Identifying the tyranny is the thing that ultimately is going to help us have an understanding.
I'm sorry you had a lousy dad. I'm sorry. I'm not your dad. And so when you blanket everybody and say evangelicalism has done this.
Political evangelicalism. Okay, that was my emphasis.
Political evangelicalism. Uh-huh. But what I would suggest, if that's your distinction, what I would suggest is that political evangelicalism is a remarkably small percentage of evangelicalism.
That is not how I have experienced it. Oh.
I have a great father. I was raised two parents who are still married, 40 some years now. Amazing people. I was raised in an evangelical church. I hear Jack say he's never met anybody in the evangelical church, and you say you've never met anybody in the evangelical church and experience that has given you hatred or talked down to you. And I was raised in a church where I was constantly talked down to, constantly, by evangelical men.
Summer, that's not what I said. That's not what Jack said. No one in the evangelical church has ever said anything done wrong. I didn't say that, Summer.
Did I mishear you? I thought you said your experience was not hatred. It was a positive, because you were talking to contemporaries mostly. Was that your experience, mostly contemporaries in an evangelical?
I appreciate that. I agree. I mean, to suggest or to maybe intimate that, and I'll use my, I've had far more conversations with Toby than I have with you, to suggest that Toby and I have ever had a political conversation. I mean, I don't think we have ever had a political conversation, and yet here is this rift.
But you started your rift with saying, I'm not your dad. You don't need to be angry with me. And his experience isn't unique. He's not treating you as his father. He's treating you as the evangelical experience he has had in general from the evangelical, like, church and political evangelicals. And he didn't put it on you. He said it's not you particularly. It is a group. It is a people group. So to turn that around and say it's personal and say, well, I'm not your father. You don't have to treat me with the anger that you're treating me with. When our entire generation had this experience.
Summer, I think it's stretching it a little bit to say that your entire generation has had that experience of evangelicalism.
Church, you would be hard put to find someone in that experience who did not experience hate from the evangelical leaders in their world perspective. Well, now, I'm not talking about my entire generation. I'm talking about the evangelicals, those of us who were raised in evangelical experiences.
Well, I mean, I can't speak to your experience. When I was a kid, growing up in Pella, Iowa, the son of the preacher, I remember distinctly when people in the church would go to my mother and father and tell them that they really needed to get us kids under control. We really were not behaving the way we were supposed to. Well, if that's
your experience of judgment in the evangelical church, that's a good example of where I'm
at. Well, Summer, if you think that No, I'm sorry. Let me dial that back. I, in my generation, am not unfamiliar with hatred that is aimed at people who have different positions, who have different lifestyles. I'm not unfamiliar with that. What I'm suggesting is that it's not helpful to write off all of evangelicalism, because that has been the case with some evangelicals.
I would like to say that we're making absolutely every effort not to write off evangelicals. That's where I'm going. Because you just hit on the heart of why it matters to show that you were, why it matters to talk to these teachers who care about things like that. That's why we're here, what we're willing to have these dialogues, because we're not willing to write it off of you. As much as everyone who was raised in my church has the right to, because of how we were treated. But we won't. Why won't we? Because ultimately we are seekers of truth and love and God. And God does not set things up that way. God does not put it in your heart to not care about you. And it's in our hearts to care about them, so we're going to show up and have these back.
I appreciate what Summer's saying. Her experience is not mine, and of course I was raised in a family that's always been appreciative, supportive, loving, and giving. It has been my experience that my family has been the target of hatred and manipulation that was expressed through unwarranted church discipline. So I'm aware of that feeling. It's not been directed toward me personally, but it has been directed toward my family. Just as you are not willing to give up the conversation because of the way you've been treated, I hope that you also see that these men and women who are of the older generation are also of the same mindset, that they are not, because of the rejection that they've seen from a younger generation, they are also not willing to give up that conversation, and they're willing to come back and try to find that. Yeah.
I'm going to try to recap my argument. I'm not going to say anything different than what I said. I think that the biggest difference in the room, biggest source of misunderstanding, is between older and younger people. I think the chief reason for the misunderstanding is that Christendom ended at some point between your generation and our generation. I sense that you did the best you could given your circumstances. We're trying to do the best we can given our circumstances. Our circumstances are profoundly different. Those differences of circumstances have led me to emphasize more and more in just my daily life, to put a greater focus on my relationships with my friends, with my coworkers, and my family, and less on political involvement, cultural involvement, etc. That's my only argument. I think that Jack's way of cutting up the pie, I thought, was a little bit too simplistic. I'm proposing a way of thinking about culture and politics, because we are cultural, political people, allows for the greater complexity of the world that we live in. Furthermore, last thing, I think the best way to exist in this world as a Christian right now is to be part of a smaller community, i.e. Gutenberg, i.e. a church, that in some way exemplifies and lives the life of Christ. That's all I wanted to say. That was my entire argument. Forgive me if I was unclear. I love my parents more than anybody, except for maybe my brother and sister. My mom and dad and my brother and sister cannot communicate. It's not because there's a lack of love on either side. My mom and dad love my brother and sister. My brother and sister are not Christians. My brother and sister love my mom and dad. They cannot communicate. This was my meager attempt to bridge that divide a little bit.
I think listening here has really been valuable in not only hearing two different generations squabble over and talk and dialogue with each other. Squabble. but one thing that kind of hit me, and I don't think that we want to forget this, and that is that we are all a bunch of sinners. And it doesn't matter if we get together in a church and call ourselves a church, or we're walking down the street or working in the political arena or whatever. We are still sinners, and we make mistakes, and life is a journey. And if I had the opportunity to raise my kids again, I would do it differently. You know, Toby and, is it?
Summer.
When you get through raising your boy and he leaves home and is on his own, you're going to look back and you're going to say, whoa, I wished I had done something different. The church has gotten hammered a little bit. I grew up in a traditional church. Looking back at some of the stuff that was going on, it wasn't right. It was the wrong focus. It was in the wrong spot. So church makes mistakes. But in spite of the mistakes that we make, I'm here because of the church that I grew up in. And I think even as a parent that my wife and I did a few things right. I just don't think we want to throw the water out with the kid. I mean, we have to look at where we've the kid without the water. But my point is simply that we go through life and we just make mistakes, and we have to look back on some of the stuff that was done that we know wasn't right or whatever, and figure out a way that with God's help and with God's direction that we can move forward. So that's kind of...
All right, I'm going to pray. Lord God, we thank you. I thank you so much for bringing me in contact with the people in this room, particularly the people that I am on faculty with. I ask that you preserve this place, Gutenberg College and Reformation Fellowship, in this broader community. I pray chiefly that you bring understanding between those of us who are having a hard time understanding each other. I pray that you bring grace and the softness of heart and allow us to not lose our convictions at the same time. We thank you for sending your son to us. In Christ's name, amen.